open up your Bibles to Genesis chapter 39. Genesis chapter 39. Well, have you ever been to maybe a summer camp? We do summer camps here at our church, or maybe a retreat, a church retreat of some sort. And in going on that retreat or getting away for that weekend or taking off for that week, you really drew close to God during that time. It was life-changing. Perhaps you can look back onto a period of your life where you were gone on a retreat and the focus of the retreat was Jesus Christ, and it was life-changing for you. You found it so easy when you were there to worship God. Everyone that was at the retreat was singing. Everyone at the retreat was focused on kind of the same verses, the same stuff, the same content. And it was easy in that atmosphere to grow closer to God. As you dealt with God perhaps at that retreat, you began to see that you had some areas of your own life that God really wanted to change. And so you were able to give those up to God really easily in that environment. And it was truly one of those mountaintop experiences for you. A life-changing moment. A moment where you really felt like it, one of the few times in your whole life you could see God clearly. And then, of course, you had to come home. You had to come down the mountain. You had to come back to the rest of the world. And you found that while you were changed, the rest of the world was not. It was still in the same condition you had left it a week earlier or a few days earlier. Your family was the same. Your husband, your spouse was the same. You found that your work situation was identical. But because you had had such a significant experience of God, you were so excited about what He was doing in your life, you truly were changed. And people could see it. They even commented on it, how you had a different attitude. You had a different approach. Things were really different in your life. But over time, because it's almost got kind of a whittling down effect on your soul, God seemed more and more distant, not as present as He was on that retreat when you were up in the mountains. Sometimes in the blur of a job, our children, homework, housework, maintaining a marriage, God becomes like a vapor to us. He becomes very distant, very far away. The circumstances of this life whittle us down. We can even have significant experiences on a Sunday morning. We come to church and we are filled with the worship. We feel the Spirit of God moving inside of our souls. We're moved by the preaching prayerfully. And hopefully at the end of a Sunday morning, you walk out of here and you are excited about living for Jesus Christ. But then sometimes real life can just hit you right in the face. God becomes distant. Easy to ignore God when He feels distant. Hard to ignore God when you're out on that retreat, when you're in that place where you're really paying close attention to Him. I find that when things are going well in my life, it's kind of easy to come to church and praise and worship. When I'm having difficulty, maybe difficulty with my wife, maybe difficulty here at the church, just difficulty at school even. I'm doing my master's degree, and so sometimes I have a lot of homework, and that can be difficult. These little things, these little distractions in my life can really cause me to get out of my focus on God. God seems more distant, more like He's out there on the fringe of reality rather than the center of my reality. I bet that's how Joseph would have felt, realizing the jealousies of his brothers, realizing that the jealousies of his brothers were so intense that they sold him to a bunch of traitors. They sold him into a lifetime of slavery. What must that trip have been like? Traveling through Canaan, actually crossing probably very close to his father's home as he was traveling down, and then suddenly took an eastward bent out towards the land of Egypt. What must it have been like for Joseph to be tied up, bound up, taken down, and then put up on a pedestal in front of a whole bunch of people he did not recognize or know, in a land that was far, far away from Canaan where he had grown up. And he was simply paraded around in a circle and sold as a common slave. He didn't know what was going on. It must have felt as though God were very, very far away. Have you ever gone to a foreign country and caught yourself alone, away from your group, from your family, from the party that you traveled with, maybe not able to speak the language? It's frustrating, isn't it? To be alone in a foreign land. Well, Joseph had no one. He had no one that he could talk to. He had no one that he could sit down with at the end of the day, unpack life with. Joseph had been sold into a lonely existence. And we pick it up in chapter 39 of Genesis. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt in Potiphar. It's our first introduction to an Egyptian. Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard. Not just any Egyptian, the captain of the bodyguard. The head of the secret service in Egypt. The big kahuna of all of the military forces that existed around the palace bought him. He bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And then verse 2, one of the most encouraging verses, I think, that is in all of the Bible, but probably a very distant reality for young Joseph. The Lord was with Joseph, and so he became a successful man. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. He becomes a very successful house servant in charge of all of Potiphar's home, despite his complete aloneness, top of the next page. A slave. He was in a foreign land. He had no family. He was far away from home. The Bible says that God is with Joseph in a unique and powerful manner. So unique and powerful that the blessing that God pours out on Joseph extends to all those that are around him. And so powerful a blessing is it that it can be noticed by outsiders that Joseph is a blessed person. So powerful is it that Joseph himself recognizes something is different about my life. And he begins to launch out. He begins to extend himself. It says that he was living in the house of the Egyptian in verse 3. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper. So Joseph found favor and became his personal servant, his right-hand man, and made him overseer over his house. All that he owned he put in his charge. It became about that from that time that he made them the overseer in his house and over all that he owned. The Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned, in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him there, he did not concern himself with anything except the food in which he ate. I mean, Potiphar turned over all control of all matters to Joseph. The blessing of God was so rich in Joseph's life that he was able to take over all of the business that was Potiphar's, all that was going on inside of his house. He blesses all of Potiphar's home through Joseph. But then there's trouble. See, right when Joseph's life seems like it's been dug out of the pit, right when it seems like he's been taken from slavery out of this horrible situation that his brothers placed him in, and God has redeemed him from that, right? God has set him back in a high place. Everything's going to be okay. You could see Joseph living out his days in the service of Potiphar, but then something horrible happens. Take a look in verse 6, second half. Now Joseph was handsome in form, in appearance. This is the Bible's way of saying he was a hottie. Potiphar's wife, number 2, letter A, observing that Joseph is an exceptionally good-looking man, invites him to sleep with her. Look at verses 7 and 8. It came about after these events that his master's wife, that's Potiphar's wife, looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge." In other words, I can't do this. It would betray the guy that has put me in control of all of these things. It would be betrayal. He refuses to sleep with her because he recognizes that it would be immoral for him to do so because it would be a betrayal against the person that had put him into the position in the first place. You know, it's amazing because a lot of us stop right here. A lot of us are very ethical people. A lot of us are very moral people. A lot of us would make this kind of a decision at work when it came to stealing something or embezzling money or doing something immoral with a coworker or anything like that. We would cease at this point, though. We would say, I don't want to betray my wife. I don't want to betray my boss. I don't want to betray whoever is in authority or whoever has gotten me to this place. But I want you to see that Joseph has a deeper reason for why he will not do this. Continue to read. Verse 9, there is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except for you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against who? God. Underlying his ethics, underlying his morals, underlying the man is a man that has become intensely devoted to God. He recognizes that this is where the blessings in his life flow from. He recognizes that this is where all of the favor that has been shown to him has flowed out of him and to other people. If he were to sin against God, it would be unbelievable betrayal. It's amazing that up to this point, from the time he was sold into slavery until this point, we haven't heard a word from Joseph. And the first things that he has to say are words that are both ethical and moral, but words that are deeply devoted to God. See, he had been thrown out on his own. He had been thrown into horrible circumstances. And rather than respond with anger towards God, rather than having God become distant and become a vapor, Joseph has exactly the opposite response. Joseph clings to God all the more in his trouble. And I wonder, do we? Do you? Do I? As we come into this place this morning, I talk to people all the time that hate their jobs. I talk to people that are struggling with money. I talk to people all the time that feel like God is so distant. And oftentimes it has to do with the circumstances in our lives. Marriages that are crumbling, people that feel distant, friends that have betrayed them, situations and difficulties that life is pouring in on us. And I wonder, do we have the response that Joseph shows us right here in Scripture? That to do anything other than obey God, to do anything other than be loyal to Him, to do anything other than that is ethical and moral in whatever situation we find ourselves in, is not just a betrayal to those people that are in human authority to us, it is a betrayal of God. That He is the one that we worship with our lives. He is the one that we serve. What Joseph has hit on is a core issue of his life. Well, despite his response, despite him saying to her, I cannot sin against God, Potiphar's wife is not terribly moved by his devotion. Potiphar's wife does not care. I think we bump into these kinds of people in our lives. People that don't care what God thinks. People that don't care about your faith in God. Perhaps a coworker, a friend, maybe even a spouse who you tell, you know what I do because I am devoted to God. And essentially they communicate back to you, I don't really care about your God. And look at what happens here. Look at verse 10. She spoke to Joseph day after day. In Hebrew, it just says that it just goes on and on and on. What did she say? She was asking him to lie with her, to sleep with her. He did not listen to her, to lie beside her, or to be with her. The phrase there, to lie beside her or be with her, are kind of posited as two different things. It's almost like she's countering with, will you come and sleep with me? Will you come and have sex with me? And he says no. And well, will you just hang out with me? Will you just be my close friend? Will you just be my buddy? Will you just come in closer? No, is his response. He'll have nothing to do with any inappropriate relationship with Potiphar's wife. And so, the worst begins to play out. Consumed, let her see, by her own lust, Potiphar's wife demands that Joseph sleep with her. Look at verse 12. She caught him by his garment. She grabs a hold of him. She is now committing a crime in any system. And she says, and this is in an emphatic tone, lie with me. She commands him. She demands it of him. I want you to come in here and lie down with me. So desperate to get out of her clutches, Joseph leaves his garment in her hands and flees and went outside. The common garments that they would have had would have been like a, in our modern vernacular, like a toga. Something that was whipped around you and tied at the waist. And she grabs hold of him, and in an effort to get away, he literally spins out of his garment, leaving it in her hands to get out of her clutches, and he is left just in his skivvies. And he runs out of the house to get away from clearly what is a woman that has become unhinged by her own lust. She tears his cloak from his body and then uses the situation to falsely accuse Joseph of rape. Look at verses 13 through 15. And let me note before we read this that the story seems improbable. That if he was going in to rape her, it is rather unlikely that he would leave his own coat lying there. That the story itself, even the way that it is written in the original language, leaves holes, leaves gaps, leaves obvious messiness around it. Let's read it. When she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew," a slang term, not a term that would have been endearing. "He has brought to us a Hebrew to make us sport, to make sport of us. He came into me to lie with me, and I screamed. When he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, see, he left his garment here beside me and fled and went outside." Knowing that that's all that she had, knowing that this woman who had been spurned by Joseph now had his garment, she holds on to it. Have you noticed how important the coat, the tunic, the garment is in all of these stories? It was a garment that betrayed Jacob. He looked at Joseph's tunic and he thought, "My son is certainly dead." In the story of Judah and Tamar, it was a garment that was used as identification. And now, once again, Joseph's garment is stolen from him, ripped off of his body again. And what is it used for? Accusing him of rape. At each point, it's as though the man is being stripped of his identity. He's being stripped of who he is. And what is he left with? God. God is his only clothing. God is his only covering. And what is the message of this story? That God is sufficient. That the covering of God in your life, when all else is stripped away, is sufficient for you and me. Do you really believe that, though? Do you believe the stuff in your life that has been stripped away, the things that you wish were that are not, the things that you see coming that are beginning to crash, the difficulty of life that you face? Do you believe that He is sufficient to clothe you, that His grace is sufficient to take care of you, that God is genuinely blessing you despite your circumstances? Do you think that if we would have grabbed Joseph and pulled him aside and said, "Is God blessing you right now?" that he would have said, "Yeah, sure, I see it. It's right there." Now, we have the advantage of knowing the rest of the story. See, in the moment, it's hard to see what God is doing, isn't it? In the moment, it's difficult to see that God blesses when things go good and when things go bad. It's hard to see that God's hand is sovereign. In other words, God is in all of it. That God is directing us for the glory of His kingdom. And that He uses the good things and the bad things to bring blessing not only to our lives, but to other people's lives too. Take a look here. Potiphar comes home and hears his wife's accusation in verse 16. She left the garment beside her. The master comes home, verse 17. Then she spoke to him with these words. By the way, this is one of the few instances where you get like a direct quote. In other words, when it says these words, it's saying quote unquote. As Moses wrote this down years and years later, he was saying these were the exact words that Potiphar's wife used. Here they are. The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came into me to make sport of me. And I raised my voice and screamed, so he left his garment beside me and fled outside. By the way, thus guaranteeing his guilt, right? By leaving the house without his cloak. You know, you can almost kind of see between the lines, in my opinion, the part of the story that is perhaps not very true. You can almost see as you read between the lines that he came in to force her to have sex and then left his garment but didn't have the sense of mind to grab it on his way out. You can almost see where Potiphar, hearing this, could doubt his wife's story. You can almost see the deception being exposed by his response. See, in verse 19, it says, when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, this is what your slave did to me, his anger burned. And in Hebrew, there's no direction that is connected to his anger. It doesn't say who his anger burned against. Now, just plain in the text, we would say, well, it has to be Joseph. I mean, he's got to be angry at Joseph, right? Well, some of the things that are leading up would indicate no. I would posit for you, I would say that it's left ambiguous on purpose. You don't know who he's angry at. You just know that he's angry. That's what the text says. His response is in verses 19 and 20 that his anger burned, not necessarily against Joseph or against his wife, or maybe against both, maybe at himself. Joseph's master took him and put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. By the way, the place where the king's prisoners were confined was the nicer jail. This wasn't the top security where all the really, really bad murderers, so to speak, were put. These were the king's prisoners. It was a little bit different kind of jail. And he was there in the jail. There's two compelling reasons why I think that Potiphar didn't buy his wife's story. One, in any form of law in Egypt, in any form of the cuneiform law, which was broader to that area, in any form of Hebrew law that would come later, if a slave forcibly attempted to rape a woman as part of that community, guess what the penalty was? This won't be very difficult for anybody, will it? Like they, you know, if a kid rebelled against their son, they said, or if a kid rebelled against their parents, they're like, take him outside and throw stones at him until he's dead. So believe me, if you tried to rape somebody and you were a slave in that society, the penalty was death. The penalty was always death. There was never a moment where the penalty wasn't death. And what do you see Potiphar do? He doesn't take him and put him in the jail with the normal population. He takes him and he puts him into the king's jail, and he doesn't have him killed. And in fact, later, the head of the prison puts Joseph in charge of all of the other prisoners. As though Potiphar came, and when he turned over Joseph, he said, I just got to get this guy out of my house. We got problems at home. And he's a part of it, and I got to get him out of here. Now, right? I'm assuming some things. I'm reading some things that are clearly not in the text. As we read the text, all we see is that his master got angry and threw him into jail. I think there's enough there, though, for us to see that the ethics and the morals and the righteousness that Joseph lived by saved his life. And that even when he was thrown into jail, he was taken from this sweet position of being second in command in the head of the royal bodyguard's home. And he is thrown into prison, literally from penthouse to prison. That even in this situation, look at what happens. Verse 21, almost paralleling verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. The chief jailer committed to Joseph charge all the prisoners who were in the jail. so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. How is that? Joseph was blessed in the penthouse, and Joseph was blessed in the prison. Joseph was blessed when he was sold into slavery, and Joseph will be blessed when he eventually, down the line, is going to meet Pharaoh himself. Joseph is an example of what God does with His chosen people when they will respond in a way that says, no matter what I'm doing, I will not do this evil and I will not sin against God. Verse 9. Joseph's blessing from the Lord is so complete in this situation that whatever he did, the Lord made it to prosper. God's Word communicates this message that He is blessing His people. He is showing us favor despite our circumstances. And I believe that it's popular in our culture to believe otherwise. I believe that when our circumstances are going well, what do we feel like? I am blessed by God. Things are going good. And so I am being blessed. And when things are going bad, when we're having trouble in our marriage, when our kids are rebelling, when things are going out of control, when we feel like life is falling apart, debt is attacking us, all kinds of circumstances that are around us are pounding us into rubble, what do we think? God has cursed me. God has left me. I am empty. I have nothing. Where is God? The human man screams out, God, where are you? You have cursed me. You have left me. You have abandoned me. And yet the overwhelming message of Scripture is that whether God gives or God takes away, that He is blessing His people. That God's hand is in the midst of your and my lives. And that He is working out His will. And even though He doesn't show us where it's going to head, even though we don't know what the end of the story is, He has provided us stories of other people who would have been just as confused, just as baffled, just as, you know, literally, Joseph would have had his head spinning, wouldn't he? Now, wait a minute, I was a slave, sold by my brothers, and then everything was fine. I was good. And then crazy lady gets a hold of me. And now, look at me, I'm back in prison. And then he gets the favor of the chief jailer. And now he's put over the authority of the prison. And pretty soon, he will have the opportunity in his position, in his authority in that prison, he will have the opportunity to connect not just with a criminal, not just with people that are in jail, but with people of influence, with people that would have connections, so to speak, on the outside. And those connections will be used by God eventually, to bring redemption, not only to Egypt, but to the whole world, and even, ultimately, to you and I. Why? Because Joseph believed that whether his circumstances were going well or circumstances were going poorly, that God's hand was in it. That God was the one that was giving, and God was the one that was taking away. That God was the one that was in control. And that ultimately he was not going to sin against God. He was not going to go back on his word because of God in his life. Do you trust that? Do you trust that what God is doing in your life is best? Do you trust that the circumstances of your life are secondary to the God that is in your life? And what are they? What are the circumstances that you are struggling with? As we come to the communion table, this is supposed to be a time where those that are believers in Jesus Christ remember Him. We remember Jesus in the midst of our lives. Are you? Are there aspects of your life? Are there troubles in your life? Are there different situations, circumstances in your life where you feel like, Jesus is a distant memory? I don't think he's been in the midst of any of that. Can I invite you to connect the dots? To bring Jesus into the midst of your circumstances? To submit yourself to Him and just say, God, whatever you're going to do here, I'm going to trust you in it. God, no matter what, no matter how bad things are, I will not curse your name. I will not reject you. I will not walk away. I will trust you. First and foremost, in all of my life, I belong to you. And whether my circumstances are good or bad, I will remember Jesus in the midst of my life. The story of Joseph has got high points and it's got low points. But you know what the consistency is through right through the middle of the story? It's that God never abandoned Joseph. And God never abandons you. And He doesn't abandon your family. And He hasn't abandoned your job. And He won't abandon the world. God is in the midst of all of it. Are you remembering Him? As we observe communion today, I'd like to do something a little bit different than we normally do. I'm going to have the elders come up here in just a couple minutes. And as we distribute communion, I just want to remind you that communion is a time for those that already have a relationship with Jesus Christ to remember Him.